You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Achieving stability in Afghanistan is a major priority for the Obama administration. The president has laid out a strategy to hamper the Taliban's resurgence, and he has dedicated an additional 30,000 American troops to the cause. Joining us now to give us an update on what's going on in Afghanistan is Sarah Chase, a former NPR correspondent who covered the fall of the Taliban in 2001 and has remained in the country ever since. She's a former special advisor to the command of the international forces in Afghanistan and runs the Arghand Cooperative in Kandahar. We have been checking in with her on a regular basis to get her unique perspective on the situation there, and I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Len. How are you?
I'm okay. The U.S. relationship with President Hamid Karzai has been under strain recently. He has been openly complaining about the way the West has been dealing with him and about the way the NATO countries have been fighting on behalf of his government. Do you think the West relationship with him will continue to worsen?
It's hard to tell from here. What I find really interesting is you know, reading in the American press accounts that some, anyway, in Washington seem to think that the slightly tougher stance with regard to President Karzai was a mistake and we should, you know, soften up a little bit more love in the tough love equation and things like that. Afghans here are stunned to hear it. I mean, you know, and I'm in Kandahar and live and work with ordinary people, some literate, some not literate, very sophisticated, politically sophisticated, as you kind of have to be when you live in a country where, you know, that's subject so much to pressure and involvement by other, by great powers and things like that. So people are sophisticated, even if not educated. And, you know, stark amazement greeted me when I recounted these reports from you know, of what the latest analysis in Washington, and people said, you've been going soft on him for 8 years, and look at the results. We've got a government that's very, very corrupt. We've got an expanding insurgency because of that, and that's what you reaped for being too gentle with President Karzai, you know, in the past. Not only do you need to keep the pressure up, but it needs to go beyond words. You need to do something. So it's quite interesting to see the divergence in views. And I think part of the problem is that although there has been a shift in approach on the part of the United States and you know, NATO and the wider coalition toward focusing more on the population, at least in words, still we have a tendency to really think of government officials as representing, quote, Afghans, rather than the population. We never bring the population's perspective into play when we, you know, when we make these analyses. And the population really wants us to crack down harder on President Karzai.
Well, can we even talk about an average Afghan citizen? Isn't the country incredibly fragmented, functioning mostly on a village level? Is there much of a sense of a national identity?
It is a very diverse, rich country of different languages, ethnic backgrounds, tribes down here in the Pashtun area. But I have to say that there is a consensus that the Afghan government is really working for its own personal benefit. You know, officials are working for their own personal benefit. And it's quite a structured process. We, again, in the West, have a tendency to think of corruption as a sort of, you know, ambient, opportunistic thing that's happening around the fringes, and it's typical of South Asia and things like that. What I find amusing is people talk about, you know, corruption being cultural. It's only Westerners who talk to me about that. Afghans never, you know, Afghans are pretty much up in arms about it. So quite interestingly, in spite of all of these cultural, ethnic, urban-rural divisions in Afghanistan, the one thing almost everybody agrees on is that the government that, in a sense, the West has ushered into power and has kind of maintained here and is really not requiring any accountability from is part of the problem. And I've been talking, you know, tonight with, as I said, these villagers from around Kandahar, and they're saying it's more dangerous here than it's been almost any time in the past because you're caught between two fires. The Taliban are are, you know, either the Taliban will kill you or the government will kill you. And so they see the government as just as hostile to them as the Taliban are. And then I literally just asked, well, okay, so President Karzai is a bit more angry at internationals, but how do ordinary people feel? And they said they feel that there's no difference between the government and the foreigners. In other words, ordinary people are angry at the government for its abuse of power and now pretty much feel that, you know, the international presence is just the same, is not restraining the government's abusive activities in any way. And so, strangely, where we were sort of hoping that our credibility would rub off on the Afghan government, it's been the other way around. The Afghan government's, you know, negative image has rubbed off on the international community.
Should there have been more of an attempt to institute the rule of law right after we invaded, when we were helping them set up their government?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In other words, what happened then was we weren't really interested in how Afghanistan was governed. We were interested in chasing Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. And so we kind of operated on the, you know, the old theme of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So the Taliban had actually done some good things in this country. I don't want to make excuses for them, but they had kicked out the most abusive of these warlords who were really terrorizing the country after the Soviet withdrawal in 1989. And the Taliban kicked them out, and people were quite happy about that. So these warlords were the ones who hated the Taliban the most, right? Because they had been kicked out of their lucrative positions. And so we allied with these warlords, brought them back into the country, and installed them in positions of power, called them the Afghan government, and then really didn't pay much attention to how that government was treating its people, so long as these warlord governors would help us chase the Taliban, right, would help us with military operations. Now there's been a shift in approach 8 years later, where we're finally understanding that how the people are treated by their government is critical to how an insurgency turns out, that you cannot defeat an insurgency on behalf of a government that the people really don't like. But we're still caught in these sorts of alliances. We're talking this way, but we really are still slow to change our approach. So when tentatively we try to be a little bit more demanding on President Karzai in terms of really the sort of looting of this country that's going on under his, you know, leadership, and he gets mad, well, we back down almost immediately. We don't yet have the courage of our convictions, either in terms of living our own values or in terms of responding to the Afghan population's desire that the looting stop, you know? And so it's been very interesting to watch. Over the last year when I was working at ISAF, at the international, you know, the command of the international forces, for the first time we developed an anti-corruption policy. It's never been even on the agenda for the last 8 years for the international troops even to address the issue of corruption, although we interacted, or the international troops interacted with governors and police chiefs and everything like that almost every day. But it was never part of their official job to look at how those folks were governing. And now it is. And so it is a very interesting development. The question is whether actions will follow words.
My guest is Sarah Chase. We're talking to her from Kandahar on her cell phone. So that's why the sound quality isn't as great as we would like. But it's fine, Sarah. I'm understanding every word. Karzai invited the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, to Kabul recently, and he gave an anti-Western speech. Is that a way of Karzai saying, hey, watch out, or I will make other friends?
You know, my mother wrote me an email and said, aren't there any parents in the U.S. government? Aren't there any mommies? Doesn't anyone have experience with, I'll hold my breath till I turn blue, I refuse to eat, you know, going limp, temper tantrums in public, I'll go, you know, in my room and I won't ever talk to you again? You know, I mean, this is a kind of behavior that, you know, it's not particularly unique behavior. And yes, of course, what he's trying to say is, you want to, you know, put pressure on me, watch what I can do. But a lot of Afghans that I've been speaking to, and in this regard more in Kabul than down here in Kandahar, people say, who is he trying to kid? Neither Iran, nor Russia, nor China, these, you know, allegedly hostile to the West neighbors here, none of them are going to put the kind of money into Afghanistan that the West has been putting in. So why, what is the West afraid of? What does the West really think President Karzai could do if he goes to court these other friends? What is he going to get from them? So instead of us continuing to say that, or these Afghan friends of mine are telling me, instead of you in the West saying you don't have any leverage over him, you have all the leverage over him. It's he who has no leverage. But somehow it's almost like what happened in Vietnam. There were some interesting critiques of U.S. failings in Vietnam that underlined, written in the 70s, underlined how the government of Vietnam was able to leverage its weakness far more effectively than the United States leveraged the strength that it had due to the incredible commitment that it was making. And it has been interesting to see a certain despondency over here, even among, you know, U.S. officials, that, wow, if we don't buckle down and achieve some kind of conditionality for what we're putting into this country, it's very hard to see how we can really succeed in the goals that we share with Afghan people.
And now Karzai has accused the West of manipulating the elections in Afghanistan, the elections in which he won.
Well, no, what I think that's gotten very confused in all of the commentary about it. I think what he's saying is that he actually won, that he didn't commit fraud. He actually won, and it was the Westerners who fraudulently reduced his score to less than 50%. I think that's what he was trying to say. And let me just tell you, I was in Kandahar on the day of the election. I started getting calls the night before the election. Friends of mine out on the border were saying they've started stuffing the ballot boxes tonight, the night before the election, and they were giving me the house where it was taking place, begging, you know, is there any way that any foreigners could come in and observe this? I know people, election, you know, not monitors, but each candidate had kind of poll watchers that they could send who were, by the Afghan border police, prevented from watching polls. And this was in districts where that were safe enough that people actually would go out to vote. In Kandahar, there are 17 districts. In 13 of those 17 districts, nobody could vote because of Taliban control. But what had happened was the government made deals. The Karzai government made deals with the Taliban.
Oops, it sounds like we have just lost Sarah Chase. We will go to a little break and come back with her in just a moment. I'm talking to Sarah Chase, who is the former NPR correspondent, covered the fall of the Taliban 2001, decided to remain in Afghanistan, and has created a business there, a cooperative that allows local people to support themselves instead of relying on U.S. largesse. And we will continue our conversation right after this. We're back with Sarah Chase. We're speaking to her in Kandahar. And Sarah, I don't know if you heard that Paul Galbraith, a former United Nations official, hinted that Karzai might be a drug user. Have you heard that rumor?
I have heard the rumor, but I think that's an unuseful, I don't think that's really the issue. The issue, you know, because interestingly, right after the election, did you hear the whole election story? Because I dropped out, and so I really do, just before I answer that, I do just want to finish that story that what I was saying is that the Karzai government actually made deals with the Taliban. In Kandahar, 13 of 17 districts were at that time in August under control of the Taliban. And the Karzai made deals with the Taliban for polling places to open. But it wasn't part of the deal that people would be allowed to vote. So the Taliban intimidated people out of voting. especially since in order to vote, you have to, you know, eat your finger, right? Mm-hmm. So that means that it's going to be visible for days that you voted. So no one in these districts voted. However, the polling places were open and the ballot boxes were there. And the result was empty ballot boxes, which were then stuffed with Karzai ballots. That's how it worked. And I'm telling you, I mean, I just have overwhelming information about how that happened.
Now, what does the Taliban get from out of that?
Yeah.
What does the Taliban get out
Sorry?
Of that? Why would the Taliban make that kind of deal?
Because, first of all, they got stuff for it. They got money. They got people released from jail. They got, in some cases...
Oops, we lost the call again. This is the problem when you're dealing with cell phones in Afghanistan. I hope that we'll be able to get Sarah back in just a moment. We have her number, and we seem to be able to reconnect with her fairly quickly, although I guess you should be warned that this thing may happen every so often during our conversation. I'm talking with Sarah Chase, who many of you will remember was one of the best NPR correspondents covering foreign matters all over in any troubled area, it seemed. And then after the U.S. invasion, she wound up deciding to stay in Kandahar, although I've heard recently that she's also perhaps spending more time in Kabul because Kandahar is such a difficult place to live in. Is that true, Sarah?
No, actually, I took a job for the last year in Kabul. It wasn't really because of danger. It was a new American administration and hopefully a new approach to Afghanistan. There really was new interest in people who had some understanding, you know, how much understanding one can have of this place is always open. But given that I had lived here for 8 years, I was invited to be a special advisor to the command of the international troops in Kabul. And I thought that was an important thing to do at that time, to try to be a conduit for what the ordinary Afghans that I've been living among want, what their aspirations are, and things like that, and try to help shape this new approach. So you had asked me why Taliban would do this deal on the elections, and my answer was they got stuff. I mean, it was a bargain, and they got, you know, they got some money, they got people let out of jail, got de facto sanctuary in some cases where the Afghan National Army agreed not to enter certain districts so long as the Taliban said that the polling places could open. So that's a precedent, in a way, of you know, sanctuary or power over land, over territory. And finally, what they got was an election that was to the discredit of the Afghan government. So they could sort of sit back and almost not do anything and yet reap a kind of psychological victory because of the tremendous corruption of the process. So you had then asked about Peter Galbraith. To me, the point is actually that President Karzai, I mean, people were predicting to me that once President Karzai has you, the West, locked in, he will turn against you. And interestingly, the radio station, ironically, that I set up here in Kandahar back in 2002, which sort of belonged to the Karzais, started spewing very strongly anti-international kind of propaganda right after the election, when the whole drama over the election was happening. And so this is it's not out of the blue at all, these statements by President Karzai. It was predicted by people I know down here in Kandahar, and it was presaged by what was happening on the radio station here.
And there have been allegations that his brother, Ahmed, I guess, the most powerful man in southern Afghanistan, somebody you know, is now involved with the insurgents, the drug trade, money laundering, and he has also been helpful for the U.S. military.
Fact.
All fact.
I mean, all fact. He's into everything down here, and you know, the sort of criticism that he has or negative attention that he's received has tended to focus on the drug trade. And that, the New York Times, for example, has written about it quite often and quite accurately, in the sense that they don't put him down as a drug trafficker himself. What he is, what he does is peddle influence. And so he allows safe conduct, partly by appointing people along the trafficking routes, police officials and things like that, and, you know, making sure that they are people who, when he picks up the phone and says, let that convoy go through, they will do so. But he traffics influence for all sorts of things. I know people who have gotten out of jail or haven't gotten out of jail based on whether they're, you know, cronies of his. He confiscates land, expropriates land. He actually, there was a big piece of land that he had expropriated that was the subject of a dispute with the village, and his people tried to sell parcels of it at a cut rate in return for votes. This was going on a year ago, January. He monopolizes business licenses. He takes a cut of customs revenues. It is very clear that he has close contacts with both mid and high level Taliban officials or commanders. I mean, it's very confusing to the people. They don't ordinary people, villagers. They don't know who's their friend and who's their enemy. You know, they're supposed to stand up against the Taliban, and yet they see that their government officials are involved with the Taliban.
Has all of this and the corruption affected the Argonne Cooperative that you've been involved with?
It has, and thank you for asking. I mean, it's been a very difficult year, I have to be honest, particularly in the fall, because in spite of the clear preparation of the corruption in the election, there really was hope that, you know, with a new American administration, not that Afghans, you know Democrats from Republicans. It's not a partisan thing from here, but they just thought a new American administration could be a new departure. There was some interesting new language about corruption and abuse of power, and that, you know, the American government is committed to better governance here in Afghanistan. And so in spite of, you know, the obvious distortion of the process, there really was hope that somehow this election might come out differently or might usher in a new era, even if President Karzai won. In other words, there was a belief that if the international community put the screws in the electoral process, then that could be a kind of warning to President Karzai that it wasn't going to be business as usual, even if he won. And when the election went down the way it went down, and when the international reaction was as muted as it was, there was kind of a massive, you know, kind of collective, it was like the end of the suspension of disbelief. And we went through it here at the cooperative, and some members of the cooperative just didn't want to do it anymore. They somehow felt that maybe I, as a foreigner, could get them a jackpot somewhere. They wanted one of these lucrative contracts with the military base. You know, they wanted some kind of jackpot to just get out of here or provide for their families in case they die, because people live in daily fear here that someone, either themselves or a close member of their family, is going to get killed. And we just had a suicide bomber today in the internal investigations agency. Four people killed, several injured, and things like that. This is happening kind of every day. And so it was a real kind of crisis to get through. And in the end, what we said was, you know, we still have to keep living every day. So if you have a better job than this one, go get it. But if you don't, here we are. And so we are continuing to make our soap, which we do here. We've added some people, so we're up to, I think, 19. And our soap is still being sold in Manhattan at Domus and in Brooklyn also. And we're going to be adding some products. We started formulating some incredible moisturizers. And, you know, this is all made of – it's an amazing place even visually here, because it looks like the moon. I mean, it's the most arid place you can imagine, and yet it produces and has since the time of Babylon the most succulent fruits and nuts and botanicals and, you know, herbs and scented. The one kind of rose that you can make rose oil out of happens to be indigenous to southern Afghanistan. I mean, so it's that kind of a contrast. We've got wild pistachio oil, you know, as the base of one of our soaps and stuff like that. So it's been, you know, I feel like we're pulling through, but it was a very difficult fall and winter, very difficult,
people
feeling extremely under threat.
Sarah Chase is talking to us from Kandahar. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But haven't things changed? The U.S. military has sent reconstruction teams to provinces around Afghanistan, supposedly to improve roads and sewers and the water supply. Hasn't that been happening? And wouldn't that mean jobs for Afghan people?
One of the things I've noticed, So one of the things I've noticed, and I just came back, I've been away for a while, so I've just gotten back to Kandahar in the last couple of days, the city's looking actually really beautiful, and they put a lot of people to work. They put a garden into the middle of the city. There's a sidewalk on my street. I couldn't believe it. And people are very happy. There's also agricultural work going on in some of the key districts. But I was just asking my friends, well, does this make people, you know, feel better about the government? And they snorted. They said, of course not. They said, this is just, you know, we're happy for the work, but we know that they're just trying to shut us up. So it's really interesting. People are happy for the work, but it's not having that hearts and minds impact that you know, I think a lot of the planners hoped it would. And the reason for that is, once again, I hate to be a broken record, but it's because we're not doing anything to curb the abusive behavior of that same government. And so what I find interesting in terms of U.S. policy is that, you know, ISAF, if you remember, came out, the International Command, General McChrystal, came out with a strategic assessment this summer that got leaked, and I think a number of people read it. But one of the sort of revolutionary things that it said was, there are two problems here. There's a violent insurgency, and there's a crisis in confidence in the government. And in fact, I was arguing to even make the first subordinate to the second. There is a violent insurgency because of the crisis in confidence in the government. But anyway, we had these two problems. And then the assessment went on to say, here's our plan for dealing with the first problem, with the violent insurgency. And then when this whole issue was debated in Washington, only that plan was debated. In other words, the debate in Washington, you know, kind of centered on, is it going to be 30,000 troops or 35,000 troops or 40,000 troops or 20,000 troops? Nobody said, wait a second, we've got two problems and only one plan. Where is the civilian side's plan? Where is the State Department's plan or the NSC's plan for how we come to grips with this crisis in confidence in the government? And to me, that was the real flaw in how the whole debate took place this fall. And so now what we have is a pretty good military plan, which, as you say, does include some civilian aspects like, you know, district-level reconstruction and, you know, these very good village-level employment schemes that really are helpful because it's agriculture. So it's down here, it's horticulture, it's trees. So if you're helping people prune their trees and make them healthier, that's going to last for you know, generations. But there, you kind of can't, I sort of feel, again, not to use the Vietnam parallel, but I sort of feel like it's Vietnam after Tet, when the U.S. Army finally figured out how to do counterinsurgency pretty well. And everyone says that, you know, Vietnam was, quote, pacified, you know, by the time the United States decided to withdraw. But that was on the district and village level, and nothing had been done to solidify and render more responsive the government. So when the United States did withdraw, the government collapsed within weeks. And I think we're kind of going down the same road here, that we're trying to sort of district develop our way out of this and just sort of pretend that the government isn't abusive and detested by the population.
But has...
So when you talk about, you know, clear, hold, build, and transfer, which is now the new, you know, kind of vocabulary, well, what is it that we're going to transfer to, even if we do get these districts safer and reduce the level of violence and things like that? If we transfer to a government that's abusing its people, it's not going to last very long.
But has the military offensive, for example, in March, been that much of a success? Hasn't the Taliban just fled to other areas, which is a classic guerrilla strategy, retreat from when the enemy becomes too strong, only to become active somewhere else? Also, just this morning, U.S. troops opened fire on a passenger bus, killing at least 5 civilians and wounding at least 18 more. I'm assuming that does not play well in the Afghan news media.
No. So let me answer those two questions separately. The first one is there was a degree of that at Marja. I mean, I've seen, or again, my friends here have seen, an influx of Taliban into the western areas in the sort of western suburbs of Kandahar from Marja. So there has been some of that. And the other thing has been the ability of Taliban, even in Marja, to continue their sort of under-the-radar intimidation techniques. And that's very, very difficult to grapple with, you know, without absolutely saturating the area with embedded, you know, troops that are living in villages and things like that. And so, you know, the fear factor remains very high. And you have to remember that Afghans are, you know, traumatized. These are people who have been through 30 years of conflict and who are survivors. And so they don't stick around and take risks. And so a couple of judicious murders, you know, or assassinations or throat cuttings of villagers is enough to scare a lot more people into submission. So there are still those difficulties with Marja. And as you point out, the sort of property damage, civilian casualties, unintended damage that we're doing to the civilians that we occasionally do to the civilians that we say we're here to protect, there's just less and less and less and less tolerance for it. And that's been an evolving situation. In other words, in the early days, there were also deaths of civilians, and Afghans were less upset about it. Not that they don't love their, you know, friends and family members, but they did understand that it's a war situation, that mistakes happen, and they believed that we were here to bring them a better future. Now, 8 years later, when they feel that what we've really done is empower an abusive government over them, they have no more tolerance for civilian casualties because there's no upside.
There's an article in The Current Nation. We're pretty much out of time, but I just wanted to address this. William Polk argues that we don't understand the Afghans' way of governing themselves with the town councils and the Pashtun social code that protects visitors like al-Qaeda. He also points out that we never really looked into the total implications of our aid programs going all the way back to the Helmand irrigation project, which was very poorly thought out. It was instituted by the Eisenhower administration.
Yes. I'm not sure what piece of that to pick up, but one thing.
Well, just
I'd
basically
like to emphasize,
that we really haven't thought much about how how the Afghans think differently than we do, and also we just really haven't done enough to understand what the soil is like when we build a dam.
Right. Well, on the first point, I would actually beg to differ a little bit. I think that there's a tendency to overemphasize, oh, these strange woolly tribal people, you know, in Afghanistan, and this notion that we are bringing and imposing democracy on people who don't want it. I see that it's the reverse. We brought criminals and warlords and put them in power over people who really did have a pretty good idea about how they wanted their government to function. And it doesn't sound identical to an American government, but, you know, the basics of responsiveness, respect for citizens, citizen input, basic services that are provided, law and order, you know, the equivalent of an FDA, the equivalent of, you know, property registers that you can rely on, garbage collection, schools, hospitals. You know, I actually think that we underestimated how democratic the Afghan people are. And, you know, we neglect the fact that it's us who brought back pretty violent criminals that the Afghan people had repudiated in the mid-1990s. We're the ones who brought those guys back in here. And so actually, although there are different ways of thinking and obviously cultural differences and vestimentary differences and things like that, I'm most struck by how similar Afghans' basic aspirations are of their government to what ours are. Now, in terms of soil, you know, horticulture. I mean, one of the things we do at Argonne is we're not introducing new crops. We're not in, you know, what we're trying to do is take what is traditionally grown here and help transform it into a value-added product that we can then sell in the West, rather than, you know, some notion of, oh, let's bring saffron in here and let's bring cotton in here and things like that. So, yes, there's certainly a lot of that, and there's certainly a lot of naivete in the way that international actors, be they development actors or more political actors, they really underestimate the ability of certain opportunistic Afghans in power to co-opt our aid, you know, and our activities. We really underestimate and have a tendency to take people at face value. You have to be really a very shrewd judge of character to function effectively here.
Sarah, we have run out of time. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I didn't get to half the questions I wanted to ask you, so I hope we can check in with you real soon. Meanwhile,
I would love that.
Take care of yourself, okay?
Thank you, Len. Bye.